Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I am Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with the legendary Guy Kawasaki, Chairman and Managing Director of Garage Technology Ventures, an early-stage venture capital fund. Guy, your books, blog, and past history as evangelist, entrepreneur, investment matchmaker, investment banker, and venture capitalist has placed you into, I would say, legendary status. What do you consider to be your most notable achievements?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure about the legendary status thing, other than perhaps being a legend in my own mind. I guess what people associate me most with is evangelizing Macintosh. I worked for the Macintosh division from 83 to 87, and I was very visible in my efforts to make sure that there was Macintosh software. And after that, I started several software companies. I've made a lot of speeches and written 8 books, and now I'm a venture capitalist. So I don't know about the legendary stuff. You know, when you start taking yourself that serious, it's the beginning of the end. Not even I take myself that seriously.
Well, you know, I actually hear that term all the time, and I recently did a keynote at a conference, and I indicated that I was going to be doing this interview, and a number of people commented and said, "You mean that legendary guy, Kawasaki?" And I said, "That's the man."
Well, if I'm legendary, what is Steve Jobs? I mean...
Another legendary figure.
I guess so.
Right. And, you know, I know that you read a lot. I mean, I've been following your blog. In fact, I would say you read voraciously, and you have a keen sense of what's coming up and future trends. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us your viewpoint of what you see as the leading new concepts or models for the world Internet industry that will really make an impact on us?
Well, in a rare moment of Guy Kawasaki humility, let me tell you that I don't consider myself a visionary. In fact, I don't consider VCs visionaries. What VCs and I do is hopefully we guess right having seen the future. But that's very different from inventing the future. I think that it's much more likely that two guys in a garage, two gals in a garage, or a guy and a gal in a garage, or in a PhD program, or in a lab, or a spare bedroom, or something like that, are the visionaries that's going to invent the future. I think my strength is my judgment about, you know, if I see various versions of the future, I might be able to pick the one that actually happens.
So do you have any sense of what you think will be something that may capture your interest in the future, or you prefer not to get into that area?
Well, you know, I'll make some guesses. I think that the world is going to evolve where everything has a chip in it, from light bulbs to toilets to TVs to everything, and everything will have an IP address, everything will be communicating. At an extreme, your toilet might send your physician an email saying, "You better check this guy for prostate cancer." That's one vision of the world. But, you know, I think that's the beauty of innovation, is that you can sit here and sort of predict and think and cogitate, but it's going to be something totally from left field that you never expected, and that's going to change the world, and I love that.
Well, that's an interesting perspective, and that's true, I guess, right?
Well, I hope so. I mean, it would be a sad thing if people, you know, I'm 51 years old, if 51-year-old people were the ones predicting the future. I prefer a world where it's 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25-year-olds predicting the future.
You know, I read a Time article recently about actually, the human brain gets better at sort of amalgamating different pieces of information after you're post, let's say, 45. And so you're really hitting your stride.
Oh, I may be amalgamating, but I'm not inventing. That's for sure.
I caught your presentation at the recent Angel Forum, and you summarized some key points for startups to be successful and to get the interest of VCs. Can you list some of those key points?
Yeah, well, you know, the first thing is most people, of course, they pitch with PowerPoint, and my first recommendation is your PowerPoint presentation should be about 10 or 15 slides long. You should be able to give it in 20 minutes, and the smallest font you should use is 30 points. So that's, you know, the 10-20-30 rule. So it's all about brevity and getting to the point. A second point is you have to have a real business model, not one of these imagined ones where you say you'll get millions of eyeballs and somehow you'll use Google AdSense or you'll advertise to them or somehow you'll monetize it. Trust me, you know, just give me the money, I'll get the eyeballs and we'll figure it out. The third piece of advice is I would tell entrepreneurs to never ask customers to do something that they themselves would not do. Sometimes when you have a cool product, you think this product is so cool that people won't mind jumping through hoops to use it. And, you know, you wouldn't do that, but you, because you're the entrepreneur, you expect people to do it for your product. And it never happens that way. So I think these are some of the key points about, you know, starting a company like that.
You also talk about something about innovation, right? And it should be something, it's like not a 10% change or...
Yes, it should be a 10 times change. To do things only 10% better, it's underwhelming. People should shoot for the next curve or to create the next curve and not just do things better, faster, cheaper, but just different. Do it different. Do it on the next curve. That's where the real meaning and the real money is made.
Well, it's interesting, and I noticed you had this sort of discussion about, you know, vision and mission statements and sort of what's the sort of the traditional model and how you sort of believe in this sort of quick phrase that really resonates or, and you have that even in your own case, right, in terms of how you describe your company?
Well, we have described our company in a very funny way. You know, we've done things as safe and mundane as capital for innovation, but we definitely toyed with the idea of calling, you know, our sort of tagline as being, we take the FU out of funding. But we didn't exactly use that, but it entered my mind to use it. My personal mantra is to empower entrepreneurs. That's what I do.
You know, one of the things I've been doing lately is I've been talking with successful serial entrepreneurs, and I sort of get this consistent message from them, and they say, hold off on VCs. Don't get VCs involved. Avoid VCs. What are your views on that?
I think that's a simplistic answer. There are times where a venture capital is perfect for a company. There are times when it's not. I don't think you should blanket say you should never go to VCs, nor would I say you should always go to VCs. You know, people need to understand that a VC is trying to create a company or fund a company that within 5 to 7 years is doing $200-400 million in business. And so there are many companies that are viable but not fundable. For example, to take an extreme, you know, a clothing store, a restaurant, a web design services company, a PR firm, an advertising firm, unlikely to be good VC deals because they're just unlikely to do $200-300 million in 5 years. So those people shouldn't try for venture capital. It's not appropriate. On the other hand, there are people who are going to shoot for the moon like that, and they are appropriate. Now, you could say you should delay going to venture capital as long as possible. I mean, that's more true, that if you can get to a prototype or get to shipping or get to revenue or, you know, even get to profitability before you raise venture capital, yes, I would say that is better. On the other hand, if you need venture capital to get to those points, you need venture capital. You should raise it. So it's not as simple as to say you should always avoid venture capital.
Well, I guess you'd have a great perspective on it because you've done it all, right? You've been an entrepreneur. You've been a matchmaker in terms of matching funding to entrepreneurs, and you've been an investment banker and venture capitalist, which you are now. So you provide a really interesting perspective that others can't have.
Well, you know, that comes with decades of masochistic experiences. What can I say? Maybe that's why I don't have the ability to have vision anymore. I've been pounded down.
I was looking at some of your postings on Forbes.com, and you know, they're interesting papers. Which one is your favorite, and can you give some key points from it?
Oh my God, Forbes.com is a long time ago. You know, the nature of Forbes.com was Q&A. It was sort of Ask Guy, right? Really, my current work is done on my blog, and in my blog, what I'm trying to do is create the highest signal to noise ratio on the internet. So when I write a blog entry, it takes me 2 or 3 hours. And the purpose, or my sort of mental model, is someone will read a blog entry, print it off, show it to the rest of his or her team about how to run a company or create a brand or schmooze or raise venture capital. I'm trying to have very, very informative blog. Now, other people have blogs that are rants and raves, and other people provide this sort of news bot service where they go all over the internet looking for interesting things that other people should read. I have no desire to do either of those things. What I want to do is basically provide almost chapters. So when I write a blog entry, it covers a topic from beginning to end. And, you know, that's why I can't post every day. I don't have the energy to write that kind of article every day. I would like to have the most informative blog on the internet.
Well, you've made the Technorati 100, and you're gearing for the top 10.
Well, it doesn't mean I'm going to make the top 10, but you know, you've got to have goals in life.
So why the blog title change? I mean, doesn't it sound somewhat academic, and maybe people won't understand it?
Which change? I've changed it several times.
Well, that recent change, you know, about signal to noise, but it's like in Latin or something.
Yeah, you know, I changed it for about 24 hours to signal to noise, but the Latin didn't translate very well, and then, you know, to really translate in Latin well, it takes a bunch of words. It's not as simple as I thought. So I put it back. I now have it. I started it off with Let the Good Times Roll, and then I translated that to Latin, and then I went to, you know, All Signal, No Noise in Latin, and then last night I said, let's just go back to the Latin, Let the Good Times Roll. The Latin for Let the Good Times Roll is Bona Tempora Volvantur, and I thought maybe I should be funny, and I'll make it Bona Tempura Volvantur, and then it will be Let the Good Times, or Let the good tempura roll. So I might do that just as a, you know, pun. Well, I'm combining a little bit of Japanese and a little bit of Latin.
So, you know, I have this question. What, in your opinion, makes your blog so successful? And I think you've talked about some of it already, you know, that you've sort of put in out chapters. But can you sort of make it in, you know, three pointers of, I'm a blogger, I want to be successful, I want to be guy like Guy Kawasaki, I want this huge audience coming in, it's building like crazy. How would I do that?
Boy, I wish I knew the answer to that. All I can tell you is what I'm doing, and what I'm doing is I'm trying to have very, very high content level. You know, not rants, not raves, I'm not a news bot, I'm not looking for I read very, very few blogs. In fact, I can't tell you I read anybody's blog. The only blogs I read is I look at the people who have cited me, to see what they're saying about me. But I literally don't read anybody else's blog every day. So what I'm trying to do again is make my blog into essentially an online book. And now to do that, you have to have a lot to say, or you have to, you know, have good judgment in who to copy. So I don't know if I can recommend this to other people.
Well, you know, it's actually, I've been following your blog, and there's so much useful information in there. So it's a situation where you go in there, and you always walk away and say, gee, I've got five key factors I can use in what I'm doing. And you always relate it to different things that a person can do, not just involving startups. So, you know, in fact, at this conference that I was speaking at, I said, you got to see this, you know, Guy Kawasaki's blog. It's got some really good material in there.
Many times I'll be driving along and I'll say, you know, I ought to write a blog about that. And I really, let me find this, you know, a little bit romantic, but I really would love the thought that people are reading my blog and they're getting information that impacts their lives, that they can, you know, actually change something or change their presentation or do branding better or do schmoozing better or do something better. I feel like it's almost a moral obligation I have that if I can get this knowledge and this analysis and put it out, it'll make the world a better place.
Okay, so when I look at your blogs then, are you planning to monetize it in a kind of direct sense, or is it sort of something where, you know, you're giving back and you want to provide information, or it's a combination of the two?
I'm running blog ads, and I have run Google AdSense, but, you know, that it never will amount to more than several hundred dollars a month. And I'll use that $700 to buy hockey equipment or pay for my league fees, but it's never going to be big money. It furthers the Guy Kawasaki brand. It probably helps me get paid speeches. It is a moral obligation, and it's very fun. I wish I could just sit and blog all day, and it's very rewarding, not necessarily financially, but it's very rewarding to do it.
Are you planning to get into vlogs or podcasts?
No, because I believe that, you know, a podcast or an audio recording should really be done very well. It needs to be. It takes, I think, because I've done some. I think it's about an 8-to-1 ratio. So if you want 1 hour of podcast, it takes 8 hours to get there between editing and redoing and, you know, rehearsing and all that and writing it down what you're going to say and scripting it. It really is a lot of work. And so I don't have 8 hours to do it. I'm not going to do it. It's too much. And I don't want to, I don't do audio interviews like this. I don't know. It took me 3 years to get to blogging. Maybe 3 years from now I'll get to podcasting.
Well, you've been doing blogging since what, December, right?
January 1st.
Which recent blog do you think is your favorite? And can you share, you know, maybe a few lessons from that blog?
Well, okay, so yesterday I did one, 10 questions, you know, quote-unquote, with Jackie Onassis. And that was based on a book that I read, What Would Jackie Do? And this is a good example of something I would do, which is there are not a lot of bloggers, particularly A-listers, who are reading books about Jacqueline Onassis. You know what I mean? And very few of them would write a blog about this. So this is kind of a aha-ism. This is kind of a wink between myself and my readers that, you know, no one else is going to do something like talk about Jackie Onassis on a blog that's essentially about business. So I like to do things like that. And again, I want stuff that's tactical and practical. I wrote a blog about the art of sucking up, which I think is a very, very important and legitimate skill. And lots of people went crazy. They hated it because, you know, I think they're all hypocrites who hated it because they're saying that, you know, you don't need to suck up to me and I would never suck up to anybody. Oh, that's crap. So, you know, I like to mix it up a little.
Well, I noticed in your Jackie Onassis blog you talk about where she sucks up when it's important and you can get something out of it, right? And there's some value being offered. Right?
Yeah, I think people, they do not like the word sucking up. It is too... probably honest. It's too, I don't know, it's too grotesque a description of what you're doing. But, you know, at the end of the day, if you or I were having, and I were having a casual conversation, we would say, you're sucking up, right? I mean, you know, we would describe the process of sucking up. So, you know, why not call it sucking up? It is. That's what we're doing.
Guy, you've had a long career, and you probably get this question quite a bit, but I'm going to ask it too. And, you know, is there... you know, three or four pointers from your career that you can pass on, sort of like in sort of a mentorship way to the audience that say, you know, I learned these things and they made a real difference, and I think if you did this, it'll make a difference in your life or in your career.
Well, I think if I had to keep one thing in mind, maybe I have two things. One is that, again, you should never ask people to do something that you yourself would not do, and that'll keep you pretty good, keep you on the straight and narrow. And the second thing is that at the end of the day, it's all about family and friends. It's not about money and companies and stuff like that. And, you know, when you get to be 51, you start appreciating things like that.
Well, Guy, you know, any other thoughts in closing?
No, I got to get back to blogging, so.
Right. Well, Guy, thank you. You know, thank you for taking the time to
do
this interview. And
glad to help.